Good morning to you. I'm Veronica Rickard, sitting in today for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Imagine a Wisconsin riddled with erratic weather, years of drought followed by months of rain. Imagine great fire sweeping through the north and the Great Lakes under armed protection. The lakes leached of native species down to the last fish. It's a nightmarish vision from writer Eric Ness, who wrote the speculative fiction piece called The Last Wisconsin Walleye for Wisconsin Trails magazine. The idea? Paint Wisconsin as it could be in 100 years if global climate change continues unabated. Today, we'll look at Eric Ness's scenario with Harriet Brown, the editor of Wisconsin Trails magazine, and Keith Riopel, program director of Clean Wisconsin. I hope you'll join our conversation this hour as we talk about global warming and its possible impact on Wisconsin. Are you worried about climate change here in Wisconsin? And what, if anything, are you doing to shrink your carbon footprint? What do you most want to preserve about Wisconsin's climate and ecosystems? Join us today with your thoughts at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. And Harriet and Keith, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Veronica.
And Harriet, could you tell us a little bit about this piece, how it came to be and what it really paints?
Yeah, we do an annual conservation issue. So every year in our February issue, we do a whole theme about conservation. And this year when I was planning the issue, I was thinking about, you know, it's great to write about small things that people can do, but it's so hard to make the idea of climate change tangible and palpable and real to people. So I started to think about, what will it be like here 100 years from now? And I approached Eric Ness, who's a wonderful science writer and has written a lot of pieces for us, and said, what do you think about this? And he kind of took that idea and ran with it. And he ended up writing a piece of fiction because, as he points out in his afterword, no one really knows what life will be like here 100 years from now, you know. And no one, there's so many variables, you can't really plan for them. But, I asked him to write a kind of scared straight, you know. I wanted a piece that would really affect people. What makes Wisconsin special? What are the qualities that we appreciate most about it? And he's a fisherman, so he kind of started with the idea of fishing and natural resources and, you know, what weather and all that. And I think he came up with a scenario that is certainly as plausible as anything anyone else has come up with. And if it doesn't give you chills when you read it, then you're not paying attention.
I can vouch for that. I read it last night, and it was riveting and yet kind of haunting because I was sitting there in front of my fire, and the piece opens with the characters making an illegal fire, and they talk about how wasteful it is to burn open fuel like that. And they're in a place called, I think it's the Northern Recovery Zone, mm-hmm. where they're trying to restore an intact Wisconsin ecosystem because everything else is kind of degraded and the soil is bad and there are invasive species and it's not a pretty sight. So they're trying to bring back Wisconsin as it was in this one area.
And I thought that opening line was very telling. You know, the fire was illegal but necessary. I don't have it in front of me, but something like that. Right away, you're in this other place where, oh my God, you're not allowed to make a campfire. And then later in the story, he has one of the characters, a young character, Aggie Walden, you know, someone who's ostensibly grown up under this whole scenario, life like this. And he has her kind of spouting things that she's learned in school, you know, things like, of course you would never eat meat. That's much too wasteful. And, right. you know, things that would presumably be taken for granted in that future time. And I think it's very powerful.
Could you tell us what kind of research Eric did for this piece?
Well, you know, I knew he had just come off of doing a fair amount of research on climate change. So I asked him to kind of, and he was working on a project that entailed looking at things on a, you know, national and international level. So I just asked him to kind of bring that information to bear on Wisconsin. And he did, you know, he talked with people, he did a lot of reading, but his goal was not to, you know, do something that was scientifically 100% accurate. He says in his afterword that he took three basic premises. One, that temperatures would rise. Actually, I don't have it in front of me. Two, that the environment would be degraded. And I can't remember the third thing.
And the third one was that competition for resources would be fierce.
Yes.
So those were his three rules for writing the piece, it
That's right.
Like.
And then he just kind of went with it.
Do you know the premise of the Northern Recovery Zone? He says in the article, well, the fiction piece, that this is based on the idea that if you do have an intact ecosystem, it will do its job by sucking carbon dioxide from the air. Is that based in fact?
Well, I think it is. I mean, I think there's, it's certainly true that, you know, as we're hearing more and more, trees do suck up carbon, and, you know, it's not just a tree here, a tree there. But, I mean, we see this even now in terms of, as we preserve wetlands, for example, that fragmented ecosystems don't do what they're supposed to do as well as large, more intact ones. So I think, and he actually had done a piece for us on preserving wetlands not too long ago, so I'm sure that was in his mind as he was writing. But yeah, the idea is you want a big enough piece of ecosystem to really make a difference.
And the other thing that comes across really strongly in this piece is the erratic weather. Fires, flooding. He talks about refugees from the east having to resettle in Wisconsin because their land has been destroyed. He calls them homesteaders, I think, which is kind of a flash from the past, sort of.
Yes, and he refers to the Hudson Seawall breach, you know, which right. is certainly something that could happen in not too distant future.
Right. So there's a real picture of at least climate instability, which sometimes it seems as though we're seeing tendrils of that now as well.
I think we are. And I think other people would agree. And I'm sure there are people who would disagree and say it's all in the normal scheme of things. But I doubt that's true.
Has this magazine hit the stands yet?
I think it's going to hit the stands today, possibly tomorrow.
What reaction have you gotten from people who've read the piece? I guess it hasn't gone out to the general public, but among the staff there, what do people think?
I think they've been blown away by it. They think it's very powerful. And, you know, in the magazine world, as in the radio world, a little controversy is not a bad thing. I'm hoping people will respond to it. And if they feel strongly that this is inaccurate, I hope they'll write to us and tell us why. Why do you think this is, you know, and if they feel like, oh, my God, this really could happen, I hope to hear from them, too.
Well, Keith Riopel from Clean Wisconsin, I want to thank you for joining us. And you've been listening along here as we talk to Harriet Brown about the piece in Wisconsin Trails magazine. What strikes you as you listen to this conversation?
Well, you're talking about erratic weather, and that, you know, reminds me that we just had a taste of that this summer, where we had areas of southwestern Wisconsin that were declared emergencies for drought, and then within, I think it was something like less than a week's time, you know, suddenly they were flooded, and we were seeking relief dollars for the you know, horrendous flooding that occurred, and all the crops that were lost and other damage from that. So we got a little glimpse of that this summer. We, you know, it's interesting, Harriet, when you say that you were looking for, in your article, looking for a way to make the issue of the impacts of global warming sort of more tangible, so that, you know, it's people can get a better grasp of it. And we were kind of thinking of the exact same thing when we put together a report last year that we issued called Global Warming Arrives in Wisconsin. What we tried to point out in this report is that there are a lot of impacts already occurring, you know, that you can see around you.
Tell us about some of those impacts.
Yeah, well, you know, we actually have, I'm sure that Eric, and you talked about his research, I'm sure that he talked to some of the researchers we happen to have in the UW system and right here in UW-Madison, some of the leading researchers on the impacts of global warming. One of the more noted is John Magnuson, who I'm sure has been on public radio programs in the past talking about his research on the later freeze-up of the lakes, the shorter duration of ice cover on our lakes in Wisconsin. And I actually, I know just before the holidays, the last time I saw Lake Mendota here, for example, Lake Mendota was still open. It wasn't frozen over. Now, it was very, very cold last night and is cold this morning, so it may very well have frozen over by now. But the cover of our report shows a picture of Lake Mendota last January, at which time there was no ice on it whatsoever, and then it shows a picture kind of a photo from January of 1948 when there were like hundreds of people, you know, on the ice fishing, and it was, of course, covered with ice. And it often is, but it was only in January, but only a few years ago, it only froze over for a really short duration of time. So that's just one example of, you know, impacts that we're already starting to see from global warming.
What about the issue that Eric Ness brings up of native species being lost because of the, well, in his article, they're lost because of flooding and the debris that gets into the waterways. Is that something that you had thought about as well?
Yeah, we, you know, it's interesting hearing. I haven't had a chance to see the article yet, but I'm fascinated by it, and I can't wait to read it. And I think a lot of what we put into our report, and we had an intern who did a terrific job of researching, you know, what are some of the impacts that are happening and what are the impacts that are predicted. And it sounds like what Eric wrote is very consistent with some of the things that are documented in our report. A lot of it is really... a lot of the impacts come from the fact that while there may be more rainfall at certain times of the year, particularly in winter, there's likely to be less in the summer, and more importantly, perhaps, is that the evaporation rate will be higher because of warmer temperatures, and what that will do is cause a drawing down of water levels and make droughts more severe. So I think this idea of you know, losing species diversity is very consistent with that. And, you know, in Wisconsin, we have so much to lose because we have such an incredibly diverse environment. I mean, so many different ecosystems, from our pine forests and boreal forests in the far north to, you know, some of the prairie and savanna types of ecosystems in the south, and just, you know, of course, very rich water resources. And one of the things our report points out is that we're very much in danger of losing a lot of the water resources, especially our cold water fisheries.
Keith, do you have any idea which areas of Wisconsin would be hit the hardest? Are there areas that are going to be more vulnerable than other areas?
Well, I think in terms of, you know, talking about species diversity and, you know, having more maybe exotics and fewer of the native species, I think if you think about that, then some of the areas where, for example, boreal forests, which we have, you know, balsam fir and white spruce and eastern hemlock, some of these just gorgeous and very valuable conifers in northern Wisconsin. We have only some very small patches of boreal forest in the north, in the far north. And so that's, you know, those are tree species we're likely to lose first. So I think some of the maybe edge areas where we have communities, forest communities or other ecological communities that are already kind of constricted in their range are probably some that are likely to be hit the hardest.
Mm-hmm. Well, both of you, Harriet Brown and Keith Riopel, you both put together your various projections for climate change. In this case, Wisconsin Trails was a fictionalized version, but based on some scientific fact. You did these to sort of bring awareness to people and get people thinking about it, and I assume to get people maybe to change their patterns. What are you hoping will be the response, both of you, to your various pieces, the Wisconsin Trails piece, and what does Clean Wisconsin hope people will do?
Do you want to go, Harriet, first?
No, go ahead, Keith.
Okay, well, yeah, we're certainly hoping that a report and a lot of the attention, and it sounds like this this conservation issue of Wisconsin Trails will be a terrific help in this way, will bring more attention to the problem of global warming and what we can do about it. There's a number of things that are going on right now that are exciting opportunities to address global warming. One is that Governor Doyle created a governor's task force on global warming last year and has been meeting since about May or June of last year, and will continue to meet the next couple of months and put together a broad range of recommendations on what Wisconsin can do to address global warming. And there were public hearings on the task force proceedings back in September, but there will be more public hearings probably in February. So coming up, which will be an opportunity from everyone around the state to comment on a variety of proposals of new policies. For example, having cleaner car standards. We just heard about the energy bill passing in Congress and the CAFE standards, the miles per gallon increasing, which is good. Certainly that's very important. There's proposals to adopt California's clean car standards, which actually are standards to address carbon dioxide emissions from tailpipes, which go even further. There's a lot of different policies like that that would certainly go a long way to help curbing, and we need to act quickly, and we need to do a lot to get where the scientists tell us we need to get by the middle of the century to avoid the most disastrous impacts of global warming.
Okay, thank you, Keith. Harry Brown?
Well, you know, on the sort of individual level, Eric talks in his afterword about ways to reduce your carbon footprint. And we've certainly written about this in the past and we'll continue to write about it, you know, replacing light bulbs, unplugging appliances, those kinds of things. But that's not my feeling is that big change is only going to come when people insist on it. And when we elect people, our leaders, who will take this very seriously and move on it. So I guess what I'm hoping for is that people will read this piece and say to themselves, oh my gosh, you know, this is going to be happening. My kids are going to be dealing with this, if not me, myself. My grandchildren, certainly. This is a top priority, you know, and I'm hoping that people will vote this issue, and I'm hoping that they will educate themselves and not kind of go along. I mean, we all want to believe that, oh, it's not going to be that bad, and, you know, it's going to represent huge change. You know, whether that's good or bad remains to be seen, but I really want people to, I don't know, be shook up and do something about it.
There is a really kind of aha moment when you read the piece, or it kind of makes you shudder a little bit, where one of Eric Ness's characters talks about, she's the young girl, she's I think a teenager or a college student, I'm not sure which, and she's thinking back to the people who used up all the resources, who squandered them, and she kind of gets really disgusted and says, planet gobblers.
Yes.
And I sort of thought, oh, she's talking about us.
She calls them, they refer to them, to us, as the thriftless, you know, and there's some line that says, well, they just didn't know any better. Well, we do know better, actually, and, you know, increasingly, to not know better means that you're sticking your head so far in the sand, you're going to be suffocating, so we really do have to pay attention to this.
We're talking this hour with Keith Riopel and Harriet Brown. Harriet Brown is the editor of Wisconsin Trails magazine, and Keith Riopel, the program director of Clean Wisconsin. We'll be taking a break right now, but I hope you'll take the opportunity to call us up and tell us what you think. If you're worried about global warming in Wisconsin, if you think maybe you have seen evidence of climate change where you live, or if you maybe wonder if it's not going to be so dire and whether or not it's being overplayed a little bit, we'll be interested to hear what you think. Call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's the Madison number. We're broadcasting from Madison today instead of Milwaukee. So the number is 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, sitting in today for Kathleen Dunn, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. When identifying badgers, bats, and bears, it helps to have an expert on hand. After 11 o'clock, Larry Mueller talks about Wisconsin wildlife with UW-Madison and Extension Professor of Wildlife, Scott Craven. Veronica Rickert, back with you, sitting in today for Kathleen Dunn here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we're talking this hour about climate change in Wisconsin. Keith Riopel is the program director of Clean Wisconsin. He's been telling us about a report Clean Wisconsin issued last year about the effects of climate change, projected effects here in Wisconsin. And Harriet Brown commissioned a piece called The Last Wisconsin Walleye, a speculative fiction piece about what Wisconsin could be like in 100 years if climate change isn't curbed. That piece is running in the January-February issue of Wisconsin Trails magazine. And we have some people on the phone now, Keith Riopel and Harriet Brown, and we'll go ahead and take a call from Steve in Richland Center. Hi, Steve, you're on the air.
Hi, I am just responding to your request for feedback from people, what they think about global warming. It's really not a matter of opinion. When you're talking about a slight increase of maybe 1 or 2 degrees over decades and centuries, it's not something that people are going to recognize walking out their front door. And just because it's cold today doesn't mean that the overall temperature of the Earth is warming. And I think that that's a misperception that a lot of people have, that if they have a cold winter, that there's really nothing to worry about. What we're talking about is a global change that's happening gradually, but it's having a huge effect in places that most people don't go to, like Greenland or Alaska or the North Pole. So I would just stress that it's not something that people can really have an opinion about. It's a matter of listening to the scientists who are watching this closely.
Thank you for that, Colin. Increasingly, of course, scientists are agreeing with that, just about everyone in the scientific community. I know some people wonder how quickly the climate change is going to happen. But Keith Riopel, do you want to respond to that?
Yeah, I would. Steve's point is excellent, I think. And what's interesting about Wisconsin and the interior, you know, of this continent, North America, is that our temperature is actually increasing much faster than the global average. You hear about the fact that our temperature increased 1 degree over the last century. Well, actually in Wisconsin, and this is completely consistent with the models and their predictions, was our temperature has increased about twice that, about 2 degrees. And again, you know, Steve is absolutely right on the hit the nail right on the head in terms of thinking, well, that's not a, you know, doesn't sound like a big difference. Well, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, speaking of, you know, the science of it, you know, in their last report, which was issued just last year, they said that global temperatures are likely to increase between 1.8 to 4 degrees Celsius, which translates to 3.2 to 7.2 degrees Fahrenheit. Okay, that the lower end of that scale is roughly about the amount of temperature change that occurred when the last ice age happened. In other words, it got that much colder. 3 to 4 degrees colder was enough to create an ice age and cover much of North America with a sheet of ice. And so that really puts it into perspective how big a change what sounds like a small change in the temperature can create. And again, here in Wisconsin, that'll be amplified because of sort of where we lie in the continent. We're warming up much faster.
In the Wisconsin Trails magazine, I think it's based on the idea that the Wisconsin would have warmed by an average of 10 degrees. Do we know, Keith Riopel, does that sound about on track with what you'd expect in 100 years? Or it sounds like perhaps maybe faster.
Yeah, well, that sounds high in terms of what the sort of, you know, the scientific range is, and a kind of a neat way to it's very scary to me, but to sort of sum up what this kind of temperature change would do overall would be if you think about states like maybe Kansas or Oklahoma, the idea would be if the temperature increased maybe in the middle of that 3 to 7 degrees range, then we would have summers something more like maybe Oklahoma's and winters something more like Kansas or Nebraska or Iowa, something like that. But if you think about those states and sort of what their sort of natural communities are like, they're not as diverse as Wisconsin, of course, and what we would lose if, you know, our weather became more like those states is really kind of frightening.
Thank you so much for the call, Steve. And we go now to Dan in Menominee Falls. Hi, Dan. Go ahead.
Good morning. I think this is just so much fear-mongering and crisis mongering. It's just unbelievable. The new religion of environmentalism. First of all, the science is not settled. And I cite for you the Copenhagen Chronicles, copenhagenchronicles.org. You can go there and read some of the summaries there. And there's many, many scientists who have been blacked out. There's a news blackout on their ideas about who have ideas that this is not a done deal and that the evidence points to something quite the opposite. And I think it's just the most reprehensible kind of conduct, this kind of fear-mongering that's being generated and being marketed. You know, it's amazing to me that it's being marketed by the press everywhere in every press agency. News gathering organization is on this and putting out the agenda. That tells me something, and this has nothing to do with science. This is consensus science, which is not science at all. It's agreeing to a consensus and an agenda.
Well, let me ask you something. I'm interested in what you say. Let's say for the moment that you're correct, and that there is climate change is not happening on the global scale. How does it hurt us to pay attention to these issues? And let's say, what are the dangers if you are wrong, if this is in fact happening, as most scientists agree?
Yes.
No, let me finish. What are the dangers of not paying attention to it versus what is the risk in raising the issue if there isn't this kind of thing happening?
You use the right word. What if I am right?
Well, what's the danger in raising the issue
right,
if you're right?
What's your response to that, Colin?
Well, it's not being marketed as scientific provable stuff. This is being marketed as a done deal that is actually going to happen, and it's only theory. You can't predict to me what's going to happen.
But how does it hurt us to pay attention to it? How does it hurt us to talk about pollution and global warming and all this if in fact it's not happening, versus how will it hurt us to talk to not talk about it?
Science. You're not talking about science. You're talking about a political agenda, which is being marketed as science. That's a fraud.
All right. Well, thank you, Dan. I'm not familiar with the Copenhagen report that you were talking about, but thank you for your ideas there. And we'll go on to Mike in Thiensville.
Thanks for taking my call. I totally disagree with the previous caller. I'm not sure where the heck he's coming from, but I thank you for having this conversation. It's certainly been going on for about the last 40 years in terms of ecology and ecosystem study. My question is, what's the plan for getting this this information formed into some policy points, getting in front of our state legislators who seem to be more concerned about lowering taxes than looking forward, as well as engaging, say, our congressional delegation and taking a more proactive approach instead of simply talking about it?
Keith Riopelle, do you want to respond to that one?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. There are a number of things. I mentioned this governor's task force. There's also a bill in the state legislature called Senate Bill 81, which kind of mirrors a piece of legislation passed in California, which would require the state to set very concrete goals and timelines and policies for addressing global warming. So the bill hasn't moved very far, although it did get a favorable vote out of the first committee, and so that's some progress. One of the most exciting things that's happening in direct response to the caller is just about a month ago, Governor Doyle, as the chair of the Midwestern Governors Association, convened an energy summit co-hosted with Governor Pawlenty from Minnesota, and at the end of that summit, a number of states, actually six states and one Canadian province, Manitoba, signed on to a greenhouse gas accord, agreeing to work together to reduce their emissions, global warming emissions, as a region, which is really critical because we had some movement in the northeastern states early on, and then California and a number of the western states have entered into a similar accord, and now for the Midwest to take serious action, which is so important because we're a huge part of the problem in terms of the emissions because of our industrial base here, and we have the potential to be a huge part of the solution. So that's really hopeful. As I said before, we have such a long way to go, but that's good progress and does create a forum for people to get involved to take action.
Harriet Brown?
Yeah, I agree with you so much, Keith, and I would take it a step further and say that not only do we have to take action as a region, but we have to take action as a nation. You know, I'd love to see us signing the Kyoto Protocol and whatever is going to come next in terms of international work on this. I mean, we are all one planet. We cannot sit here in Wisconsin and say, well, we don't have a problem like, such and such a place. So I would say, I'm sort of an old rabble-rouser. I'm hoping that people will, get out and vote this issue and not stand for leadership that hems and haws and is more interested in lowering taxes, as you say, than in doing something about this.
I want to ask you both about something in terms of maybe impacts that are already being felt here in Wisconsin in terms of climate change. I was up in northern Wisconsin, Madeline Island, this summer, and the lake was surprisingly swimmable, and the locals were saying it was a lot warmer. It used to be you'd hop in for 5 seconds, turn blue, and get out. And while we were up there, I also read an article that just happened to run about how the lake levels were lower. Are you seeing that? Is that part of climate change?
So the lake levels are absolutely lower. I've seen research. I can't cite it for you right now, but I've seen research that's tracking that. That's not in question. I'm not surprised to hear that the lake is warmer. It only kind of stands to reason. Although, it's what's interesting about the whole notion of climate change is it's not necessarily like a linear kind of thing. The temperature warms up, therefore the lake is warmer. It's ecosystems are very complex. We have more Arctic ice melting in some. That may make the water temperature colder in some places, warmer in others. It's really, it's once you start messing around with the sort of homeostasis of the planet, I think anything can happen. So I'm not surprised to hear that.
Keith Riopelle, have you heard anything about that?
Yeah, well, certainly, you know, Lake Superior, as you experienced firsthand, hit record low levels this past summer, and I was just hearing on your news broadcast earlier this morning that Lake Michigan was 2.5 feet lower than it was in 1986, I believe they said. And so Lake Michigan is very low as well. And, you know, those the levels of the Great Lakes are cyclical, have historically been cyclical, and we don't know all the reasons why they get much higher and much lower. And the predictions for global warming have the models show a range from potentially a slight increase to a very large decrease. And so in general, a lowering of those lake levels is consistent with what the climate change models predict, and it's mostly for the reason I mentioned before, because of increased evaporation rates. And so that, you know, that these very low lake levels right now in the Great Lakes, are they due to global warming? You know, probably not. But is it a, you know, is it a snapshot of what we might see in the future and be greatly exacerbated by global warming? There's a good chance it is.
Okay, go back to the phones now. We'll take a call from Ellen in Madison. Hi, Ellen, you're on the air.
Oh, hello. Thank you for taking the call. I just wanted to make a comment on how people in southern Wisconsin ignore people, what's going on in the Northwoods. I'm speaking of up around Burnett, Washburn County area, where they have been in an extreme drought for over 3 years, where people are, us included, we have a home there, are worried about our wells going dry, where we're going to have to really go deep, deep, deep in order to get water. Our lake itself is down probably around 7 feet, which is very unusual.
So you're talking about a drought that's been going on for the past 3 years?
Oh, yes, at least.
Have you heard of that, Keith Riopelle?
Yeah, and I, you know, it's to varying. I know that much of northern and central Wisconsin, it was experiencing terrible drought for much of last year, and as the caller points out, for years running now. You know, there was also a story this morning about the Great Lakes Compact and an effort to try to protect the water resources of the Great Lakes, and the legislature is actually dealing right now with legislation to ratify that compact, but maybe more importantly for us as a state, it would create a program for addressing our water quantity, you know, issues, and require some water conservation practices and manage our water resources so that we don't lose our groundwater aquifers and we don't have springs drying up and streams drying up. And again, all of that is very consistent with the global warming modeling. So it's an important time to bring it up, but we really need to act and act quickly to address it.
Yeah, one of the things in Eric Ness's piece was he talks about losing control of the Great Lakes, a body, a sort of federal or body that sort of takes over control of the Great Lakes. And he talks about, you know, the water levels dropping so low that you can walk all the way from Milwaukee to, you know,
New Muskegon.
Yes. Right. So it's definitely part of the scenario.
We're going to take a quick break right now, and we'll come back and talk further about possible climate change in Wisconsin. We've been talking about the speculative fiction piece that's going to be running, actually, coming out today in the January-February issue of Wisconsin Trails magazine. We've been talking with Harriet Brown, who's the editor of that magazine, and the piece is by Eric Ness. And we've been talking with Keith Riopelle, program director of Clean Wisconsin. If you'd like to join in the conversation and tell us about your concerns facing Wisconsin in an era of climate change, call us this hour at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. I'm Veronica Rickert, sitting in today for Kathleen Dunn, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Identifying badgers, bats, and bears, it helps to have an expert on hand. After 11 o'clock, Larry Mueller talks about Wisconsin wildlife with UW-Madison and Extension Professor of Wildlife Ecology, Scott Craven. Veronica Rickard back with you, sitting in today for Kathleen Dunn here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking with Harriet Brown, the editor of Wisconsin Trails magazine, and Keith Riopelle, the program director of Clean Wisconsin, about the possible effects of climate change on Wisconsin, both in 100 years, as is painted so vividly for us in the picture, the piece, The Last Wisconsin Walleye, that runs in Wisconsin Trails magazine starting this month. And Keith Riopelle has talked about the report his organization Clean Wisconsin had issued in the past year. And we're going to be going back to the phone lines now and take a call from Mike in Fontana. Hi, Mike. Go ahead.
My call. Mm-hmm. I appreciate this program. I think it's a very important issue, particularly resource conservation is a great interest of mine. And I'm worried about the leadership, though, the political leadership on these questions. You know, we look at the Democratic hopefuls, among them John Edwards. The guy lives in a 29,000-square-foot house. You know, and these people are admonishing us that we need to drive smaller cars that get 40 miles per gallon. And, you know, it's all about what are the little people going to do? You know, and then there's Albert Gore Jr., you know, Al Gore. He's burning $30,000 worth of electricity per year in his house, according to the newspaper in Nashville. You know, and these people are flying around in corporate jets, you know, not even often with 300 other passengers in a commercial flight, but in jets that are flying around with six people in a jet. Nancy Pelosi flies by herself sometimes in a big jet all by herself from Washington, D.C. to back to her district on the West Coast. I mean, these people are profligate, major users of resources. And then, you know, one of your guests earlier talked about the little girl who's concerned about the resource gobblers. Well, there they are.
Sounds like you're looking for leaders who are going to walk the walk, Mike.
Exactly.
Harriet Brown, you want to respond?
Oh, I'm 100% with you on that one. I think that, you know, again, until it hits home to each one of us personally, it's very easy to sort of rationalize. I know that, I mean, I have a lot of respect for Al Gore, but I know that he participates in carbon offsetting. You know, I'm not sure what I think about that practice. Can you buy your way out of, you know, does it really... Is it still, you know, is it okay? Does it make it okay?
What is carbon offsetting? I'm not familiar with that.
It's when you basically pay, you know, you sort of calculate your carbon usage. Let's say you're going to take a plane trip or in your corporate jet or whatever. You sort of, there are various carbon calculators online. Eric Ness references a couple of them in his afterword. And you sort of calculate how much carbon you're going to be sucking up and or putting into the atmosphere. And then you, there's a way to sort of buy... Put money towards something that's supposed to offset them. I don't know. You
that's
know, certain things can't be bought, really.
Have you heard of that, Keith Riopelle? Are you familiar
yeah.
with?
Yes, I have. And I think you have to be very careful about that. I mean, there aren't really well-established, you know, markets here. There's a very infant sort of market in Europe where they're clearly ahead of us, but are, you know, starting to... use a market for getting reductions of greenhouse gases. But, you know, in the short run, especially, it's so critical, as the caller points out, to take personal responsibility and do what we can. But the bigger picture of the politicians is clearly the need to act to put strong policies in place. As Harriet mentioned before, while the personal actions are critical, we need huge sweeping changes. I mean, the scientific community tells us we need to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions by 60-80% by the middle of this century to, again, avoid the most disastrous effects of climate change. We've been steadily increasing our climate change emissions in Wisconsin, in fact, in Wisconsin, faster than a lot of states. And so to turn that ship around to get a huge decrease is going to take, most importantly, a lot more political will, and especially, as Harriet pointed out, at the federal level. I mean, and Bush has been just such a disaster on this issue that, you know, we sort of assume that we've been reading the headlines about how the United States once again in the talks to do the, you know, the international talks on the next version of Kyoto, how the U.S. has again been the obstacle in coming to agreement under Bush's lack of leadership.
You're talking about Bali?
Yes.
And I read in I think it was the Los Angeles Times, that the U.S. was basically shamed. Someone actually said, if you're not going to help, get out of the way.
Right. And so it has been a disaster at the federal level. Of course, there are numerous bills out there to create a global warming, you know, regulatory program at the federal level. But whoever mentioned the, you know, mentioned the candidates, I think it was the last caller, we really need to be, you know, tomorrow's Iowa caucuses, we need every one of those candidates to pledge to take strong action, you know, to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions in this country. That's absolutely essential.
And it's not going to be, you know, it's not going to be popular. The steps that we need to take are not going to be popular, and they're not going to be in line with cutting taxes and, you know, making life easier and more pleasant. They're going to require some sacrifice, and we, the people, have to sort of make up our mind, you know, is it worth it to us, or do we just want to go our merry way and we don't care what happens to our children and grandchildren?
And while I completely agree with that, Veronica, you mentioned to the caller who, you know, sort of naysayed all of this earlier, you know, the notion of, well, what's if we are wrong, what's bad about, you know, addressing it, making the error in that direction, which, of course, we need, if we're going to err, we need to err in that direction. What's really interesting about this is we're going through this task force proceeding. Illinois has already gone through a very similar process of looking at the policies they need to make a change on the magnitude that I mentioned before, 60 to 80%. And what they found when they modeled the policies of, you know, requiring cleaner cars and not, you know, building more coal, you know, dirty coal-fired power plants, which are our biggest greenhouse gas emitters, and forcing reductions at the current plants and so forth. And when they modeled the whole gamut of different regulations, what they found is that they could reduce the emissions by more than 60%. And if they did that, they would increase state economic activity, they would increase jobs, and they would actually lower energy bills, which is sort of counterintuitive, but the reason that happened is because the only way to get to a 60% reduction is to really aggressively pursue energy efficiency and conservation.
Well, it does seem as though it has to be incredibly aggressive. And it's interesting to me, who's been watching and following this, you know, in the papers, and that when changes are made, it seems to take an incredibly long time. You know, we need to require hybrid cars or something, and they say, well, it'll happen in 50 years. What is the obstacle to change? It seems as though maybe you're saying quicker, more radical change would benefit the economy more.
Well, it would, and part of the reason is because in order to create an economy based on clean energy resources, we would shift away, and Wisconsin is in such a perfect position to take advantage of this. We have no fossil fuel resources in the ground that we extract. We have no coal, we have no oil, we have no natural gas. So if we move away from those things and power our economy on, you know, wind turbines and solar panels and energy efficiency and conservation, those are things that can benefit the economy in Wisconsin, because we can build those things. We actually have a, you know, terrific manufacturing base here that's poised to help build those things, and that creates jobs in Wisconsin as opposed to, you know, in the Middle East, you know, where we're getting oil from, or, you know, in, you know, Texas or Canada, where we're getting natural gas from, that sort of thing. So we're really in a good position to have a new clean energy economy and take advantage of it.
Going back to the phones now, here's a call from Steve in Madison. Welcome, Steve. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. And unfortunately, I called in for one question. As I've been listening, I realize that it's more complex, so I need to break it into a couple of parts.
Sure,
first of all, I do believe in the fact that the global warming is happening, and I do try to do the things that I can do, and I also believe in buying locally and so on and so forth to help with that. But I'm an over-the-road truck driver. I put on over 1 million miles in the last 7 years. And when I drive through major cities, I see cars with one person in them. When we look at this, are people willing to give up what I do? I move material thousands of miles across the country on a daily basis. And are they willing to give up that thing that they could have from California because they live in New York? Or are they willing to create the jobs and the businesses in that area to create those things? And are they willing to go to mass transit instead of 100,000 cars on the road in Milwaukee at 9 o'clock in the morning?
Thank you for that call, Steve. Those are some good questions.
Yeah, you raise such a great issue. You know, it really does come down to it's not an abstract theory. We're talking about making changes that affect each and every one of us in our daily life. So what if you can't buy strawberries in February, you know? Eating with the seasons, buying local, as you say, creating a kind of infrastructure in each place to sort of provide the things that now come from all over the place. I think you're dead on. You know, what are we willing to do? How it's not necessarily change for the worse, but it would represent big change. Are we willing to do that?
What do you think, Keith Riopel?
I agree. You know, I think buying locally is really important for all kinds of reasons. I think, you know, it's obviously better for the local economy, but it's also a better use of our resources and more efficient use of our resources. But at the same time, our current infrastructure is so wasteful in so many different ways that the biggest gains and the biggest reductions of greenhouse gas emissions will come with doing things more efficiently, you know, as opposed to, you know, not necessarily giving things up, but just doing them much more efficiently. I mean, having regional, you know, light rail or regional commuter rail corridors and that kind of thing, it just makes so much sense. And it's, I think it was Harriet that said, they're not going to be easy or popular decisions necessarily, but we do need to invest, you know, millions and millions of dollars into a new infrastructure, which, again, isn't, in the long run, isn't a bad thing for us. It's a good thing. It creates lots of high-paying jobs, for one thing. But it takes commitment. I mean, it's a very real, tangible, you know, decisions, and at times with budget deficits, it's, you know, I think the key is looking long-term, not making our decisions about, you know, how we invest our resources and our money, you know, in a short-sighted or near-term way.
Thanks a lot for the call, Steve. And we take one now from Dave in La Crosse. Hi, Dave. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you. I deal with arboviruses and vector-borne diseases. And it's interesting that over the last, we have 30 years of good data on emergence of certain mosquito vectors and tick vectors for disease. And we're seeing earlier emergence of Oclerotatus triseriatus, which is a vector for encephalitis and other vectors. And we're seeing two invasive species that have come, were found in one Oclerotatus japonicus found in Dane County in Illinois, Iowa, Minnesota this year. And in one aspect, it is baffling because we're losing federal dollars to do surveillance and to do control work for these vectors. The CDC is losing money. On the other side of it, you know, we're seeing an increase in the opportunity for human infection. And with this triseriatus, the disease is transovarian, so it's passed down through eggs. So numbers of broods and the opportunity for movement becomes really important in controlling that disease. And I think that aspect, there's so many things of this that are so interesting and neat, you know, from global dimming, and, you know, we've got over 200 years worth of data on that. So if someone comes in and says it's political, it's not scientific, they're not looking at the scientific work, I think. And they're not, you know, the term theory, a theory is a well-studied, accepted process. So, but it, from a public health standpoint, I just think it's so interesting. We're facing challenges. Environmentally, we're going to see vegetation change with this. I think it's interesting, too, with the mosquito-borne stuff is that we'll see earlier emergence, but because eggs are photosensitive, we may not see on the other end. They're going to go into diapause at a time because it's based on hours of sunlight, not heat. But science is complex, I guess what I'm saying. But fun.
All right. Thanks a lot, Dave. You brought up some interesting things I didn't know about. Had you, Harriet and Keith, have you heard about what our caller's talking about there with the ticks and the...
Not so specifically, but, you know, again, we don't know what will happen as invasive species, run rampant because of climate change. And I agree, science is complex, and I'm sure we cannot even hypothesize some of the big changes that are coming our way.
Yeah, I very much appreciate the Dave's call and point. I used to work in an arbovirus research lab here at UW tracking La Crosse encephalitis, and it's the exact sort of thing. You didn't mention that one specifically, but type of mosquito-borne disease that he's talking about. And we didn't even get into all of the direct human health impacts of global warming, and in which there are many, ranging from just, you know, the heat itself, which is a much bigger killer than cold, and will continue to grow in that way, to these diseases and more more ground level ozone and all kinds of health impacts that, you know, would be a whole nother show. But he raises a really good point.
And we have time for one more call. We'll take a quick one from Dave in Northeast Iowa. Hi,
yes,
Dave.
Two points. One was illustrated by the comments just now. It's not going to be possible to predict the effects of global warming, all of them. For example, another example was the Great Lakes story, because at the same time that the water is going down, there's been an increase in rainfall. Now, who would have thought that? And for the naysayers, it's important to point out that there are other good reasons for cutting back on greenhouse gas emissions, like air pollution, and also, of course, to save money on increasing energy costs. So that argument can also be brought to bear on this issue. Thanks.
Thanks for that call. And real quickly, Harriet Brown?
Oh, yeah, that's exactly right. You know, and sometimes that's the way people understand it. In your own pocket, it can save you money to cut back on energy usage. So that's a good reason to do it.
Well, thank you both, Keith Riopelle and Harriet Brown, for joining us this hour. It's been really fascinating. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you very much, Veronica. Appreciate it.
We've been talking with Harriet Brown, who is the editor of Wisconsin Trails magazine, and Keith Riopelle, the program director of Clean Wisconsin. And I apologize to Cobb, the folks on the lines whose calls we couldn't take this hour, but we appreciate you calling in anyway. And I also want to thank Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour and Keisha Mabra for on-air production. I'm Veronica Rickert, sitting in today for Kathleen Dunn, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.